Welcome to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. We are back with another Friday roundup of the week's events, and we begin with the Metro News. And we have once again gathered our WFPL newsroom team, Gabe Bullard, Erica Peterson, Devin Katayama, and Philip M. Bailey. Welcome back, everyone.
Thanks.
Hey.
Happy Friday to you. We welcome your input as well. 502-814-TALK, that's 502-814-8255, or toll-free 877-814-TALK, 877-814-8255. You can send us an email at news@WFPL.org. We're on Twitter at WFPL News. You can send us a tweet, and you can also visit us at Facebook. Gabe Bullard, let's start with you. Some developments with the Louisville Orchestra, another contract offer rejected last night.
Yeah, this latest offer was one put together by the mediator. I guess to make this have the most sense, I'll go back to the beginning of the week. That's when the media blackout lifted on Monday, I believe. What had happened was Sunday we obtained a copy of what turned out to be the management's latest proposal in this dispute. They've been talking about a new contract since before the last contract expired, since before the orchestra entered and then eventually emerged from Chapter 11. It's been over a year now they've been talking about this next contract. The current contract or the previous contract expired in May. So this proposal that we found on Sunday would have called for 50 musicians instead of the 71 that are there now. The rest would, if necessary, be hired on a temporary per performance basis, and then 30 weeks in the season instead of 37 weeks at the current pay. That's a little bit higher than the management had previously said they could do. They've been working with the mediator and with this man, Ralph Creviso, who's a nationally renowned consultant being paid with a grant secured by the mayor, this anonymous donation. So the musicians turned down that offer on Monday. Their counteroffer was for 57 musicians for 30 weeks, and that would be increased to 60 musicians in 33 weeks. They say this would not cost any musicians their jobs. They say about 14 musicians have left town looking for other work, as happens from time to time anyway if a musician gets a better offer or something like that. So but this dispute, they say, has encouraged more musicians to leave. So they say this 57 plan would not cut any jobs. The management rejected that offer. And so there was some back and forth behind the scenes for much of the week. The mediator, Henry Monjo, put forward this most recent offer that was rejected last night. That was for 54 to 55 players would be increased over time. And he says the management would have accepted that. The musicians turned it down. The management put out a statement shortly afterward, after it was rejected, saying that they were disappointed, that they are going to have to look for some creative solutions, and they thanked Monjo and Creviso for their work. Well, I talked with Monjo, and he said the talks aren't over, that Ralph Creviso isn't done consulting either. He's doing a lot of his consulting by phone, but Henry Monjo said if the musicians are going to get what they want, there's going to have to be a new fundraising plan out there. The orchestra management has said that would be very difficult, but at this point, Henry Monjo is the one saying these talks have to go forward.
So for now, anyway, the talks will continue.
Yeah, that's where it's left right now. This compromise could be something in between, maybe even one of the existing offers and the mediator's last offer. It's unclear right now what further concessions either side is willing to make. Though there is a sense that while this impasse is frustrating for all sides, that they're fairly happy that at least some movement has happened.
So a good chunk of the season has now been canceled because it's so late, and there's the possibility of even more being canceled, right?
Right. Orchestra concerts for September, October, November, and now December. There's one concert in December. They've been called off. The ballet has been using recorded music, as they've planned to do for a while. So anyone planning to go see, say, the Nutcracker next month or in December will see it set to recorded music. The opera is working out these per-performance contracts with the musicians as well, or per-show contracts.
And there was also talk of using replacement players, I guess a threat from management. Is that still a possibility?
Yeah, the tone of that threat changes depending on who you talk to and who has heard it. But they say that at one point it was put out there that the management might seek to find new players. That's not likely. Even Robert Berman, the orchestra CEO, would say that would be very difficult, given that Louisville is not home to a lot of freelance musicians. It's not a larger city like a Chicago or a New York that would just have a lot of musicians around who weren't already in the orchestra. The other difficult thing is that the orchestra is on the unfair list at this point. That's the American Federation of Musicians list of organizations that they say are essentially unfair and not negotiating properly with the union. And any union member who crosses that line who would play for the orchestra or any group on the unfair list would be subject to fines and penalties and would essentially end their career or could end their career at that point. So it's very unlikely any union members are going to come and play. And as far as non-union musicians, those they would be difficult to find. Students are a possibility. However, it's unlikely a student would want to start his or her career with this on their record.
Now, this has been dragging on for months. Is this starting to have kind of an effect on the patrons and the supporters of the orchestra?
Yeah, even in explaining it, you can hear it sounds fairly tedious in the presentation of 50, 55, 70, 33 weeks. These numbers flying around that to the musicians, to the management, to a lot of people in the arts community or the diehard symphonic music fans might be a very big deal and are a very big deal. But for the average person who might buy a ticket casually to go to the orchestra, it's starting to seem a little tedious. We've seen it even in the reaction to stories we've put out there that at first there was a lot of support on either side of the debate, a lot of people wanting to participate in this conversation who are interested in the stories. And with each subsequent story we've put out, it seems like the response has been a little bit less. So there is a concern about relevancy. I talked with Orchestra CEO Robert Berman, and we can hear a clip of him talking about that now.
I say that the fact that the orchestra has relatively small audiences today is a byproduct of the fact that we have gone through the same public narrative over and over and over, because each time that we confront this labor impasse and the infighting, there is a percentage of the audience that turns their backs. So that's why we say whatever solution we can come up with here, mutually, hopefully, it has to be fundamentally different than what we've done in the past. What we need at the end of the day is a solution that this community will believe in, and which will motivate the donors to guarantee that our future will be better than the past.
And Musicians Negotiating Committee Chair Kim Tischner essentially agrees. Here's what she has to say about that.
Yes, the orchestra, I'm sure, is losing relevancy because we're not performing anything. And so, yes, I see a very grave danger letting this go on any longer.
And this could be summed up, if people want to go to our website and search for this story, in a reaction that I got during one of these, when I was out covering one of these stories, when the musicians had held a very small demonstration outside of the offices of the orchestra to turn in a letter rejecting a contract proposal that was long, long ago. And I walked across the street after this protest, and there was a group of people who were standing across the street watching, and I asked if they knew what it was about. They didn't know. I told them, and the reaction was, well, so what?
Yeah.
And so they're not only losing, you know, ticket sales now, but, you know, future donors, they're possibly losing interest from younger people who might buy tickets in the future as this drags on.
It would be a shame after 75 years of having an orchestra to lose it, but as this drags on, I think people are getting more, you know, fatigued with it, seems like.
Yeah, and it's starting to become a real concern, as we heard, for the musicians and for the management.
All right, Gabe Bullard, thank you. We'll come back to you in a moment. This is State of the News on WFPL. We have our WFPL news team rounding up the Metro news of the week. Going to turn now to Devin Katayama, who has been on a bridge patrol again. This is a Metro Council committee meeting, Devin, yesterday regarding the Ohio River Bridges project, and they're asking, they're intervening, or not intervening, but asking River Fields to end litigation.
Yeah, it was a Transportation Bridges and Public Works Committee. The resolution basically asks River Fields and the National Historic Preservation Trust to end litigation against the whole Ohio River Bridges project. What was interesting is that River Fields was invited to the committee meeting, and they, earlier in the week, agreed to come, and then the day before, they redacted that invitation. And it was unclear if River Fields actually did that until, at the committee meeting, the council members released a timeline, a chronological timeline of communication with River Fields that showed this. So I thought that was a very interesting aspect of the whole thing. Also in the committee meeting was an email from an attorney, and at the committee meeting, it was unclear whether this attorney was representing River Fields, But in the email, it said that the Metro Council was bullying Riverfield, and any decision, any resolution by the Metro Council could affect future federal court decisions. So they had the county attorney address, or somebody from the county attorney's, William O'Brien, address the Metro Council or the committee. And he said that basically the federal government or the federal courts aren't going to weigh anything that the Metro Council does, and that it's kind of a ridiculous claim to assume that they would.
So Riverfield's a conservation group, obviously, and has been involved in this suit mostly against the project affecting the East End Bridge, right? They're opposed to the environmental impact that it would have.
Right, and the environmental impact statement has already been done. Another one has already been done previously this year. Any future actions could require more of these. And they're saying basically they want to start August 2012, start construction of the East End Bridge. And in order to do that, they're going to need to first have one of the six proposed methods of going forward with construction in place by early next year, because five of the six methods require that the state of Kentucky change some of the state legislation, and that would need to be done really early in the new year. And so everything needs to be in place for them to go ahead and start this construction. The litigation is obviously one of the bigger things that is holding this whole project up.
And Riverfields argues that you can go right ahead and start and get your money together and start the project. There's no injunction. So what keeps the state and the folks that want the bridges from moving forward?
You know, that's something that wasn't addressed too much at the committee meeting. Bridges, the Bi-State Bridges Authority did give an update on, they had a meeting earlier in the day, and they kind of gave an update on what kind of progress they were making. And there's just a lot of different things that they are kind of monitoring right now, and they are deciding on. I haven't been following the story too much, but I'm not too clear what else is holding them up at this point.
All right. This story goes on, and we'll have more for it later. Thanks, Devin. I'm going to turn to Erica Peterson now, who had a story that broke last evening. A judge has ruled with the coal industry and a suit against the EPA. What's going on there, Erica?
Yeah, well, it's still unfolding, and we're trying to figure out exactly what this means, Rick. But last night, what happened was a federal judge ruled in favor of the coal industry. It was a lawsuit brought by the National Mining Association, which is an industry group in D.C., and they were suing the EPA over a technicality. There are these permits for what are known as valley fills, which you use in mountaintop removal coal mining, and they require a certain type of permit. And in 2009, the EPA announced it was going to begin what they called an enhanced coordination procedure. And what that meant was that they were going to, usually the Army Corps has authority over these special permits, and the EPA has the power to veto them. But the EPA basically wanted to get in a little bit earlier on the process and work through the permits with the Army Corps and give, you know, they can give advice, they can offer comments, they can offer suggestions on ways to reduce the environmental effects of these valley fills. So the judge ruled that the EPA was overstepping its bounds, that it didn't go through the right process, and that the Army Corps should be the one who was reviewing these 404 permits. So that's a victory for the coal industry, basically. Mm-hmm. But the real complication comes when you actually look at what that means. And I talked to a bunch of people today, including Tom Fitzgerald from the Kentucky Resource Council and Bruce Scott of the Kentucky Department for Environmental Protection. And they both basically agreed on one thing, that this decision might not mean anything. Because what it could do, and I think Tom Fitzgerald said, be careful what you wish for. It's a victory for the coal industry, but it basically means the process reverts back to where it was, which is the EPA has veto power over these permits. So if they aren't in earlier in the process, which they are holding up the permits for sure, if they don't have the opportunity to offer advice and comments on them, we could just see an increase in vetoes of the permits.
I see. Now, would this have any effect on the EPA's actions in, you know, other areas like air pollution?
No. I mean, all it does is it kind of deals a PR blow to the EPA, because the coal industry and politicians and other industries have basically been complaining that the EPA is overstepping its bounds. And, you know, that's a common complaint with air pollution regulations, with coal ash, things like that. So this is kind of a morale blow, if you will. But that's it. One thing that's probably important to note, too, is we've heard a lot of talk about a war on coal and Kentucky suing the coal industry. That's something that pretty much every politician has been mentioning during this campaign season. And this is not what they're talking about necessarily. The Commonwealth of Kentucky wasn't involved in this particular lawsuit. What they are involved in is a kind of companion lawsuit, which should be decided this spring. And that's really on water quality standards and conductivity in streams impacted by coal mining.
All right, Erica Peterson, thank you. We'll be coming back to you in just a moment. I want to turn now to Philip M. Bailey, WFPL political editor. And some interesting turns in the Kentucky governor's race. Governor Steve Beshear has widened his lead, Philip, over David Williams in the latest poll.
If you can imagine it. At this point now, the race, the poll numbers show that Governor Beshear is ahead of State Senator David Williams, the Republican nominee, by 31 points. Back in June, the poll showed that Senator Williams was down by 21. So as we get closer and closer to Election Day, the numbers are getting worse for Senator Williams, as Governor Beshear widens his lead. That was something we addressed and discussed with Senator Williams when he was on our program yesterday. He discussed his jobs platform, his jobs plan, which is pretty ambitious. Talked about his energy policy, talked about his views on Jefferson County Public Schools. And I think it's safe to say that Senator Williams has run a very issue-oriented campaign, whereas Governor Beshear has mainly focused on his administration over the past 4 years, weathering the state through the storm. Obviously, Senator Williams has some problems amongst his own base. The poll numbers, for example, if you look into some of the crosstabs, the poll numbers show that among abortion rights supporters, pro-life voters, 43% support Governor Beshear, whereas only 39% support Senator Williams. 55% of churchgoers support the governor, whereas only 31% support Senator Williams. Among gun owners, 52% support Governor Beshear, whereas only 28% support Senator Williams. Those are key GOP constituencies. And earlier on Thursday, David Adams, a prominent Tea Party leader, he sent out a message to supporters saying that the Republican Party just basically needs to cut Senator Williams loose, that they need to focus their money and their resources on the lower ticket candidates who obviously need some help overcoming a 30 margin deficit at the top of the ticket, and pointed out that, you know, Senator Williams only has 51% among GOP supporters at this point supporting his campaign. When we addressed that to Senator Williams yesterday, he said that those voters will come home. But when we talked to Mr. Adams, he indicated that there's a bigger problem out here and that problem really is focusing on Senator Williams amongst those key constituencies.
The biggest enigma in the Williams campaign is David Williams himself. He has a quarter century long voting record, and he came to Frankfort and spent much of his time, most of his time, if not nearly all of it, not as a conservative, but as far more of a moderate than he's proposing that he is now. And you look at some of his votes on taxes. He complains about Steve Beshear's last 9 budget bills, but Beshear couldn't have enacted those budget bills without David Williams' yes vote on every single one of them. And so we've seen taxes go up. We've seen debt go up. We've seen $3.4 billion worth of federal stimulus dollars come into the state, and that's now all gone. And we keep going deeper into the tank, and David Williams has played a big role in that.
And you see there Mr. Adams challenging the conservative credentials of Senator Williams. Senator Williams responds by saying that Mr. Adams is insignificant to the party. He's a marginal figure, pointing out that he was the campaign manager for his former GOP opponent, Phil Moffitt. So there's still some infighting going on with Senator Williams, not only amongst the Tea Party, but amongst the Republican Party. Now, the Williams campaign has not officially responded to Mr. Adams's remarks, but there have been some Williams supporters who have pointed out that, you know, Mr. Adams has made some, what they consider to be some disparaging comments about Senator Williams via Facebook and other areas and other arenas. So while Mr. Williams faces this very insurmountable sort of deficit against the governor, he still has to face this issue with, does he have the complete support of the Tea Party? Does he have the complete support of his own GOP base?
Is Senator Williams getting any help from the National Party at this point?
The Republican Governors Association did fund some ads early in the race, but at this point they haven't put any money into the race since then. The only group that's really running ads other than the Williams campaign itself, is this Ohio-based group Restore America. They've run a number of ads supporting Senator Williams and attacking Governor Beshear. But the only thing that's worse than the poll numbers for Senator Williams is the contribution numbers. I mean, the governor is hammering him as far as contributions are concerned. Many political observers have pointed out that this could be, you know, a blowout, a landslide victory to the degree that Pepe Martin was back a few years ago. So we're seeing, I think, a situation where a number of people are beginning to question what this means beyond just the gubernatorial race. Does this mean that Senator Williams could be politically weakened as a leader of the state Senate? Does this mean that the Republican agenda could be weakened in Frankfort as a whole? So this is having ramifications depending on how large this is. At the end of the day, the only poll that matters is Election Day. But if it's as bad as the polls indicate, this could have ramifications far beyond Senator Williams himself.
All right. Thank you, Philip. This is State of the News on WFPL. And if you'd like to chime in on our conversation, we'd like to hear from you. 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255, or toll free 877-814-8255. Gabe Bullard, let's go back to you. A big announcement yesterday from, or ruling, I should say, from Attorney General Jack Conway that could have an effect on the big hospital merger here in Louisville.
Yeah. What had happened was, well, there is the hospital merger, University of Louisville Hospital, which is operated by a University Medical Center. It's merging with Jewish Hospital and St. Mary's Healthcare and a division of Catholic Health Initiatives. This has raised a lot of questions about how women's healthcare will be handled, reproductive health in general, end-of-life care. There are some solutions that UofL or the university hospital officials have offered, but for the most part, there are a lot of questions. When there are a lot of questions, there tend to be a lot of open records requests filed. Well, the ACLU had filed an open records request to get some documents from University Medical Center. It was denied. UofL, UMC, they all said that the hospital and the medical center were private and therefore not subject to open records requests. So the ACLU appealed to Attorney General Conway. The Courier-Journal joined onto that as well. I believe they had had some open records rejected. We've had some records requests rejected too, I believe. You know, these requests get sent out all the time, right, and sent back, and there's a lot of back and forth involved. But he, Conway ruled that, in fact, the UMC is public, and they would have to comply with these open records requests. And that's a pretty big ruling. The University Medical Center folks say they're very disappointed in it.
And there's going to be a forum later on this month. I believe the health department is sponsoring this, where the principals are going to get together and talk about it.
The Board of Health is sponsoring it. And yeah, they are calling forward all of the principals, which they have all agreed to go. The principals previously turned down a forum that was put together by some of the critics of the merger. They said they didn't think they would be able to get fair treatment, but they are going to show up for the Board of Health forum later this month. The Board of Health has been meeting with them as well in private, and I talked with some folks over at the Board of Health who had said that the board will put out a statement essentially saying, you know, what their concerns are for the merger, what they think should happen to make sure care is preserved for everyone, that access to care and the quality of care isn't changed. They'll put out that statement after the forum, which is coming up in just a couple weeks.
All right. Thank you, Gabe. Before we run out of time, I want to go back to Devin here and talk about Occupy Louisville for a few minutes.
Yeah.
This is, of course, spawned by the big demonstration on Wall Street in New York. And we had our first demonstrations earlier this week, right?
Yeah, we had our first demonstrations on Tuesday. It was really interesting to watch this develop because it was very unclear at the beginning what exactly was happening. It was unclear. They're calling this a leaderless movement, which I think causes some of the problems that have occurred so far. It was at the beginning, it was unclear. They had two Facebook pages with two events, two locations, saying that you should either meet at the Belvedere or at 4th and Jefferson, which is Aegon Plaza. So I went down there, and there was a good amount of people at Aegon Plaza, and then I decided to check out the Belvedere, where there were people chanting, and apparently that's where they had the permit. However, most people wanted to stay at 4th and Jefferson, so a big part of that group walked back to 4th and Jefferson, and that's where you see them today. The group originally was around 100 people who came and left at that first day. Now we're seeing a group of around 20, you know, people come and go in that group as well. But you are seeing some more organization. They're holding what they call general assembly meetings, which essentially they'll meet from 12 and 6 o'clock, and they'll discuss what they want to kind of protest for, what they want to do, what next actions they're going to take. At this point, they are waiting. They have applied for a permit for 6 in Jefferson, which is Jefferson Park, which would be right outside the City Hall. It's unclear whether they're getting any kind of support from David Tandy, who's the councilman in that district. But they seem to be close to finding out if they are going to, in fact, get a permit for that area, which would allow them to stay there 24 hours a day until, I believe, December 31st is what they're applying to the permit for.
Have they talked about anything beyond just demonstrations or taking action, like in the election and the sort of thing?
You know, I haven't heard any specific. That's what's interesting about it. It's very unclear what they're trying to protest for. They mention a lot about we are the 99%, essentially right. Saying that 1% of the population holds a majority of the nation's wealth. But when I've been talking to certain protesters, they seem to be all over the map. You know, you talk to one, you hear something about 99% federal government, big banks. You talk to another, they're very specific about certain things that are happening in Louisville. So I think that's what part of the General Assembly part of their version of the General Assembly is trying to figure out exactly what actions they're and what they are fighting for.
All right. Thanks, Devin. We're going to be talking, incidentally, in the second half of the program with Mark Widener of the Wall Street Journal. He's going to tell us about what's going on with the Occupy Wall Street folks in New York City. Erica Peterson, let's go back to you. You reported that there has been an ethics complaint filed over some very untoward remarks made regarding inbreeding and folks in eastern Kentucky. What's going on there?
Yeah, who doesn't love a good story about inbreeding?
Gets everybody's attention, doesn't it?
Yeah, what had happened was earlier this summer in July, I believe late June or July, a law firm which has ties to the National Mining Association put out a statement basically to refute a study that was done by researchers at West Virginia University. And the study basically raised some questions about the connections between birth defects in counties where there was mountaintop removal coal mining, and showed that there was a slightly higher concentration of birth defects in these counties. And so the law firm put out a list of methodology problems with the study. And unfortunately for them, most of those problems nobody really paid attention to them, because they started their argument by pointing out that consanguinity or inbreeding is prevalent in those areas and could be accounting for the birth defects, which, you know, a lot of people raised a stink over. People are obviously very offended that this comparison was being drawn. So now there's a lawyer at the Charlotte School of Law in North Carolina who has filed an ethics complaint. And what he's asking is for the Washington, D.C. Office of Bar Counsel to look into the claims. His claim is that this law firm put out a statement that they knew was misleading in order to kind of get more business from the coal industry.
Mm. And they did walk back after this came to light. They kind of walked back that statement about them.
Yeah, they immediately removed it from the website as soon as a couple of reporters, me and a couple of other people, started looking into it and asking about it. They removed it from their website, and they issued a statement in regards to this ethics complaint too, saying that the complaint was baseless, and they chastised the lawyer for bringing this up after they had already removed it from their website, and they also apologized for any offense it may have caused.
So what's this complaint mean? What could happen to the attorneys?
Well, it depends. The Office of Bar Counsel is going, if they decide initially that there is merit to the case, they're going to start looking into it. And if they find that some ethical violation has happened, it could really run the gamut. It could be anything from just a reprimand to disbarring the 4 attorneys whose names were on this statement.
All right, Erica, thank you. Philip, I want to quickly get to you about get an update on the first district seat, of course, now vacant following the ouster of Judy Green. Where do we stand now on the effort to fill that seat?
Yeah, we're moving a little forward with that now. Next week, next Tuesday to be specific, we will see the 15 candidates who are applying or vying for the seat. They will be interviewed by the Metro Council. They will have a few minutes to address the council and share their views and vision for the district, which covers parts of West and Southwest Louisville. They'll get to do that, and then council members will really just get to ask them a few questions about what they think of the district, what their views are. It's unclear whether they will address the previous scandal of former Councilwoman Judy Green, but that will be an opportunity for us to really hear from these candidates and these applicants for the first time. The next week after that, the next Tuesday, on October 18th, the council will then select the replacement for her, someone to fill that seat by a majority vote. Generally speaking, these have been usually smooth operations. Last year, when former Councilman George Unseld died, it was a bit of a number of votes, but I believe like 36, 30, 7 different ballots before a candidate was chosen. So at this point, we're moving forward with that situation. I know the number of candidates have been discussed and are jockeying for the seat. Names that you keep hearing, obviously, Donovan Taylor, Ray Barker Sr., who filed the initial complaint against Councilwoman Green, Attica Scott, who I think has been mentioned a number of times. She was actually up at the Metro Council regarding the union exemption law debate. So you see a number of candidates who are jockeying for the position. And at this point, council members don't want to comment on who they're leaning towards one way or the other. They want to give everyone a chance to articulate their views and vision for the district, and we'll see in the next few weeks who will be the representative for District 1.
All right, and quickly, Gabe, we're going to finish with you. Some changes this week for 4th Street announced, right?
Yeah, it's good or bad news, depending on what you think of the Louisville clock, but it has been confirmed, as we talked about last week, that the Louisville clock will be coming to Theater Square. That's going to be happening fairly soon. The construction is already underway. So a bevy of private donors that have put in some money for that. And then also at 4th Street Live, there's some changes happening. The Red Star Tavern is being evicted. They just hadn't been paying their rent for some time. That business will be gone. I talked with a spokesman for the mayor. The Cordish Company is typically very hard to reach. The Cordish Company also controls all the leases in 4th Street Live. Mm-hmm. The mayor's spokesman was fairly confident that another bar or restaurant will move into that space, so there may be little change on the actual business front. As far as the border space, which is the big question right now in 4th Street Live as to what will happen with it, the first floor is most likely going to be another bar or restaurant. There were a lot of folks who had pushed for possibly a grocery store, some sort of retail store, Target or something like that, to fill that space. That's most likely not going to happen, at least on the first floor. The second floor could be separated, and that could turn into something else, but we may be hearing an announcement from Cordish in the next few weeks about what will be happening there.
That's a nice space in that Borders, former Borders building.
Yeah, it's a very large building, 2 floors, spacious, and so it'll be interesting to see whether or not it will be split up into multiple businesses or what's going to happen.
All right, that's going to end our Metro segment. Thanks again to Gabe Buller, Devin Katayama, Philip M. Bailey, and Erica Peterson. Great job as always. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rick. Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to talk with Joe Sanka of Leo Weekly to talk about the DREAM Act and where it stands in Washington. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, the DREAM Act is legislation that's languishing in Congress. Its authors say it would allow millions of undocumented young people who came into this country with their families a path to citizenship. Its chances of passage, however, appear doubtful. It cleared the House in December, but it's been held up in the Senate, and it's opposed by Minority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky and his GOP colleague, Senator Rand Paul. Joe Sanka at Leo Weekly has written a story about the DREAM Act and what its passage would mean to a young woman here in Louisville who wants to attend college. Joe, welcome to State of the News.
Thank you.
Well, tell us about the DREAM Act. What is it? What would it do for these young people?
DREAM Act would give an opportunity for kids who were brought to this country when they were 15 years old or younger, and it would allow them a chance to gain a path to citizenship. If they were to enroll in a 4-year college, go there for 2 years, or enlist in the military, they would have a chance to apply for legal citizenship eventually in 6 years. But the DREAM Act seems pretty doubtful right now with the makeup of Congress.
So, as I mentioned, it won House passage, and I think Congressman Yarmuth voted for it,
yes.
The only Kentucky delegation member to vote for it, but it has been held up in the Senate.
Yes, it passed last December in the House, but Mitch McConnell led a filibuster of the bill in the Senate, even though it had the support of about 55 senators. And with the makeup of Congress right now, with Republican control over the House and the lag of the filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, it seems doubtful that we're going to see this any time in the next year or so.
Why are the Republicans opposed to it?
They see it as amnesty, that they're simply rewarding what they term, you know, criminal behavior of breaking the law to come into the country. And if you give them citizenship, then you're just going to reward unlawful behavior, and they term it as amnesty.
And I read a quote from your article. Senator Rand Paul went on to say that this would give these young people a path to Democrat voter registration, as he put it.
Yes. He sees it in very unforgiving terms, I would say, of the people that were brought here as children, that if you register, if these people become citizens, they're just going to become Democratic voters. And he seems to be not joining in the fight to get those voters, but rather deny them citizenship.
Now, this legislation's been introduced in some form or another over the years, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. And it used to have a lot of support among Republicans. In fact, Indiana Senator Richard Lugar was once a co-sponsor of the act and voted for it last December. He faces a pretty tough Tea Party challenge right now, and his challenger has been hammering him on his support for the DREAM Act. In fact, he took off his co-sponsorship of the act, and he no longer is a co-sponsor. So it's still up in the air of whether Richard Lugar, if that actually did come to a vote, would actually be supportive of it.
Now, you found someone here in Louisville who would be and talked about how she would be affected by it. Her name's not a real name, but we'll call her Barbara. She's 19 years old. Tell us about her.
Well, she was a really good student. She graduated from a high school here in Jefferson County this year, and she received almost a 4.0 grade point average. She was a member of the National Honor Society. Her teachers give her high praise, and she would love to be in a state university right now, but she is very fearful that in applying for federal student aid, in applying for colleges, that she will be found out and people will deport her, which has in fact happened to in the past year in Lexington. Two students at BCTC, a community college, were actually found and detained by ICE, the Immigration Service. And so she's very fearful that she would love to go and be in college right now, but she's fearful that she's going to be found out and deported. So she's stuck working at a restaurant right now when she very much would like to be in college pursuing a degree and hopefully going to law school someday.
Is there a good estimate as to how many young people would be affected by this if it were to pass?
Well, it's estimated that 65,000 people per year graduate from high school that would be eligible for this. And it's estimated that 2.1 million people would be eligible for a path to citizenship if the DREAM Act would pass.
Any idea how many Barbaras there are here in the Louisville area?
I'm not sure. There's not a clear – it's very hard to get an exact number on that.
Yeah.
The ACLU isn't entirely sure what the exact number is, but there are a considerable amount. In fact, Barbara has lots of friends who are in the same situation as her who just recently graduated high school.
So this legislation as it's written now appears dead in Congress. Is there any chance that somebody could maybe rewrite it or tweak it a little bit and bring it back?
Well, it would have to be tweaked a lot to get the support of the Republican House and get enough through a filibuster in the Senate. Barack Obama is a very vocal supporter of it. He did a speech recently this summer in Texas where he again advocated passing the DREAM Act. But for the time being, it doesn't look like we're going to see anything, perhaps in 2013, if there's a significant change in the makeup of Congress. But right now, it doesn't look good.
All right, Joe. Joe Sokka from Leo Weekly joining us to talk about the DREAM Act. And thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
Joe Sokka from Leo Weekly. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Sean Cannon of our sister station WFPK about some news going on in the music world. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News on WFPL. I'm Rick Hallett. We're going to turn our attention now for the next few minutes to some things going on in the music world. And joining us to talk about it is Sean Cannon. Sean hosts a program After Dark on our sister station WFPK from 9 p.m. to 1 a.m. Monday through Thursday. And he is also the editor of BuzzGrinder.com, which is a music blog. Sean, welcome to the program.
I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Let's talk about this case. These killings that happened in the hip-hop world years ago, Tupac Shakur and Biggie Smalls, and there's been a lot of speculation about what happened, who did
right.
it, and whatnot, and there's some new information coming out from an LAPD, a former LAPD detective.
What's right. Yeah, a detective named Greg Kading recently self-published a book. It was called Murder Rap, and he alleges that Suge Knight, who was the head of Death Row Records, and Sean Puff Daddy, P. Diddy Daddy Combs, whatever his name is this week, that they were actually the guys that engineered both murders, of course, Suge Knight for Biggie Smalls and Puff Daddy for Tupac Shakur, you know, when the East Coast, West Coast rap feud was at its height. And apparently, according to Kading, in his book, he said that the LAPD suppressed evidence. They even had taped confessions from hired guns saying that these gentlemen actually hired them to do the job.
Now, Tupac was killed after a boxing match in Vegas, right?
Right, right.
And I've forgotten about Biggie Smalls. Was that elsewhere?
I think that he was actually on the West Coast at the time as well when that happened, but I can't remember the specific circumstances. But that's why both murders were investigated by the LAPD.
Now, what has been the reaction in the industry to this latest information?
Well, it's kind of hard to gauge because obviously it hasn't made a huge splash. This former detective self-published the book, but at the same time, Puff Daddy recently sent a letter to LA Weekly saying that he did not do it. In fact, he said specifically, "This is pure fiction and completely ridiculous." So, it must be substantial in some nature if one of the primary subjects of the book is actually responding to it in the first place.
Now, are the police still actively investigating these cases?
It is an open investigation, but I think considering that there hasn't been much headway made in the last 6, 7, 8 years, that I don't know that this will change things, especially since he was obviously a member of the LAPD and there's likely a reason why mm-hmm. he's not now.
Yeah. Is this East Coast, West Coast feud still going on? You don't hear much about it as much.
No, right? I think that that's kind of... It's over partially because a lot of the most popular rap music these days is coming from the South, whether it's Atlanta or even like the Southwest as kind of sort of a mecca for that. And also Minnesota, surprisingly, has been putting out a lot of the avant-garde rap. So, while there are still people obviously in New York and L.A. doing hip-hop music, they're not necessarily these huge, centers of power like they were in the 90s.
You don't think of Minnesota as a mecca for
No, I mean, you wouldn't, but, apparently, like I said, the cutting edge of hip-hop music is there in Atlanta. There are a few other places sort of interspersed around the United States. It's kind of, it's a different world. You do think of New York, L.A., that's about it, but it's not really that way anymore.
We're talking with Sean Cannon from our sister station WFPK about some news in the music industry. We'll take a giant leap now from hip-hop to the world of folk music. And we lost a well-known British folk musician this week, Bert Jansch. Am I saying that right, Bert Jansch?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, you might be thinking, well, that name doesn't necessarily ring a bell. But the thing is, he is one of those guys who influenced almost everyone. I think what's really telling is Smith's guitarist, Johnny Marr, he said he completely reinvented guitar playing, and he set a standard that's still unequaled today. That's kind of a big statement. But he goes even further. He says, without Bert Jansch, rock music as it developed in the 60s and 70s would have been very different. You can hear him in Nick Drake, Pete Townsend, Donovan, The Beatles, Jimmy Page, and Neil Young. So while you might not know him specifically, there is a good reason why, this is an important guy, and it's important that he passed away.
So people called him the British Bob Dylan.
Yeah, that's correct. But, if you're wondering sort of what to expect from him, it's very much in that vein. He, he was sort of in vogue right there at the height of the British folk revolution. And, depending on who you ask and how they think about him, you'll get a lot of different reactions because he was also in the band Pentangle. And, even Led Zeppelin specifically stole music from him. I know that they kind of have a history of stealing from musicians, but usually it was guys that weren't in a position to fight. In this instance, it was very apparent and obvious that it happened, and he almost took legal action. But at the time, you're not going to take Led Zeppelin to court.
Right. And there's a great appreciation. I think I heard it on the air yesterday, and you can catch it online now at npr.org on their All Songs Considered blog. And before we let you go, I want to talk about the controversy this week with Hank Williams Jr. and Monday Night Football. What's going on there?
Oh, yeah. Bo Cephas kind of stuck his foot in his mouth, although I don't think he sees it quite that way. He was doing an interview, and they were talking about a recent golf match between President Obama and John Boehner, if I'm not mistaken. He said, if memory serves, that's like Hitler playing with Netanyahu, mm-hmm. Of course, referring to Obama as Hitler. ESPN, not too happy about that. They pulled his music intro, all my rowdy friends are coming over tonight. I think they pulled it indefinitely, but now it's official. They're done. But Hank Williams says it's not their doing. He's the one that decided it. He said specifically, let me get this quote right because it's not exactly the best the best worded thing, but he said that they stepped on the toes of the First Amendment freedom of speech. So therefore, me, my song, and all my rowdy friends are out of here. So he decided. Yes, apparently he decided. I think it's one of those he said, she said situations.
Right. And this was an interview with Fox News. He didn't specifically compare Obama to Hitler initially, but they came back and asked him about it.
Right, and he kept going. Initially, it was just sort of a simple statement. He was ready to leave it there. But, of course, Hank Williams Jr. never wanted to step away from controversy.
All right. Sean Cannon is the host of After Dark from 9 p.m. to 1 a.m. on our sister station, WFPK, Monday through Thursday. And he's also the editor of BuzzGrinder.com, a music blog. Sean, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is State of the News on WFPL. We're going to switch gears now and head up to New York. In mid-September, protesters began gathering on and around New York's financial district in a demonstration now known as Occupy Wall Street. Protesters say they've come out to, among other things, express their outrage over what they call corporate greed and fraud on Wall Street and elsewhere, and the subsequent government bailouts. The movement has spawned similar demonstrations across the country, including here in Louisville, as we have discussed earlier. And joining us now to talk about what's going on in New York is Mark Widener, a MarketWatch.com columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Mark, welcome back to the program.
Well, it's David Widener, but...
I'm sorry, David.
I'm happy to... I'll respond to just about anything.
My apologies, David.
Sorry.
Well, who started this demonstration back in September?
Well, you know, there have been a lot of sort of splinter groups out there trying to get some traction against the financial interests in New York, and there have been a lot of unions involved. But this was sort of a... this is sort of a new group that developed this Occupy Wall Street movement, and it's a lot of mostly young kids, college-educated, who frustrated with the system and with the opportunities that they've been presented after going to school or during school, and it kind of grew from there, and now it's pulled in... unions and people, environmentalists and people against artificial colors in your food and just about everything now. It's become a real melting pot of causes. But at the core, people who are upset with the inequality of wealth in this country, they call themselves the 99%, which is really all of us. I don't know how much money you make, but it's... the 1% being the 1% that controls 60% of the wealth in the country.
Now, these folks were initially criticized for not really having any focus, but some I've heard that were been talked to were quite articulate about why they're there and what they want, and they seem to have, as time has gone by, gelled a bit since the beginning.
That's right. You know, they came out at the end of September. They came out with sort of a platform. And it was a 10-point smartly worded platform that listed a few things that they stood for, and there were a lot of things such as workers' rights and the right of a democratic society to participate and not to have financial interests ruling Washington through lobbyists and campaign donations. So they distilled it a little bit, and I've heard that there's other rules that they're going to be supporting. They want a return of the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated investment banking and banking, and, of course, the repeal of that is being criticized as one of the causes of the financial crisis. But mostly they want... a leveling out where people can of their generation can get a job basically. It's been criticized for being an anarchist or communist or leftist movement, but really these kids, a lot of them who I talk to, say they want to participate in a capitalist society. The problem is that they just don't have the opportunity to go out and make their way. They've done everything right. They've worked hard. They've gone to school and gotten straight A's, and they've been left out in an economy where nobody wants them.
Has Wall Street, as a whole, responded to this? Are they paying any attention to them?
Well, I would say that they're starting to pay attention now as it really is growing downtown. At first, it was just a matter of simple. Law and order with they were marching across the city and sometimes getting in confrontations with the police and so they drew some attention that way, But I think in more recent weeks, or the last couple of weeks, there's been a new awareness of what they're looking for. And I would say Wall Street people, you know, at first who were just annoyed with them snarling traffic are now, you know, responding to them at least, even if it's just to argue with them or be critical of them. I would say that this Occupy Wall Street movement definitely has their attention.
Got about 30 seconds, David. Where do you see this thing going?
I see this as really a Tea Party sort of emerging from a different part of our society. And a lot, whereas the Tea Party is sort of older, educated Americans, I think this is a similar movement by young people. And it'll be interesting to see if they can sort of follow that lead of the Tea Party and organize strongly enough to influence politics and election. We have a big election next year, and they could be a part of it.
All right. David Widener, with the MarketWatch columnist with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for joining us again.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate
Take care. It. That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about topics discussed on today's program, visit WFPL.org. State of the News is produced by the WFPL News staff, which includes Gabe Bullard, Philip M. Bailey, Devin Katayama, Erica Peterson, and Graham Shelby. Our production team, led by Laura Ellison, Brad Yost. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening. Have a good one.